Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our show today, we explore the bureaucratic hurdles of the international adoption system and how it's keeping children trapped in orphanages around the world. Then we switch gears and discover whether our state symbol, the Wolverine, ever actually lived here. But first, Michigan Democratic Congressman Gary Peters has made it official. He will run for the U.S. Senate seat, opening up with the retirement of Carl Levin. The three-term congressman is from Bloomfield Township in Oakland County, which is an area considered important to winning a statewide race. The GOP has yet to announce who it might run for that up-for-grabs Senate seat. And now we turn to the situation in the city of Ecorse. Officials say the financial emergency in the city has been resolved. Ecorse has been under the control of an emergency manager since 2009, when then-Governor Jennifer Granholm made the appointment. Well, now comes word the city's budget is balanced and a $20 million deficit has been eliminated. But the announcement does not mean elected officials get all of their authority back right away. That's because Joyce Parker, Ecorse's former emergency manager, has given the city a two-year budget that it must follow. Parker, who we should note is also the emergency manager of Allen Park, joins us now. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Can you explain to us why you and the governor feel that Ecorse is no longer in a state of financial emergency?
Well, a number of changes have taken place in Ecorse. For example, coming on board in 2009, there was a deficit in place of $14.6 million, which was the cumulative deficit. In addition, there was a $5 million structural deficit. So as of today, both of the deficits have been eliminated. In addition to that, the city had issues related to internal controls as far as managing its finances. The audit reports generally were not submitted on time, and the costs related to the audit reports were over $200,000 because of the lack of information. To date, that has been rectified. The audit reports are very good reports. The city's fund balance is in the positive, in the black right now. And the cost associated with monitoring the city as far as an audit is like $30,000 as opposed to $200,000 because the records are in place and everything is intact. So I think when you look at the fact that the internal controls are in place, the deficits have been eliminated, we've been able to reduce operating expenses by about $4.3 million. We reorganized various departments, which included the police and fire services into a public safety department. We privatized emergency medical services, and we reorganized the controller's office and the building department. So overall, the city is leaner with less employees in place right now, but more efficient.
But this had to have been a hard, painful process for all involved.
Well, it was certainly a painful process. I think to a great extent, the responsibility was shared by a number of stakeholders in Ecorse. The residents there, fortunately, was able to support the effort that took place. The elected body there, you know, took a reduction in pay in order to help with stabilizing the city. The collective bargaining unions also had to actually take concessions because of the city's financial status. And again, I mentioned earlier the reduction in the workforce. So it really was, I think, a painful process, but it was one that everyone was involved with and understood the rationale and the need to make the changes.
Joyce Parker, you will now be part of the city's Transition Advisory Board. This is the board that's appointed by Governor Snyder, and we should just kind of make it clear to everyone that this TAB is a feature of the state's newest emergency manager law. It lets the state appoint a board after the EM is no longer needed, just to make sure the city doesn't go back to spending more than it has. So I guess I want to make sure I'm clear. How much authority does the Transition Advisory Board have as compared with elected officials in Ecorse?
Well, with the elected body there, they will, the mayor and the council will be able to conduct business for the city. In addition to the elected body, the other component is that the city now has a city administrator that will handle the day-to-day operations related to the city. So the mayor and council will handle policy issues. The city administrator will handle the day-to-day operations. In those areas, for example, like with the budget or making major purchases, contracts, selling major assets, then the transition advisory board would be a step in that process. The mayor and the council would actually review whatever asset they plan to sell or changes related to the budget. They then will present that to the transition advisory board for some type of review and approval.
Now, the transition advisory board, if I'm correct, can stay in place indefinitely, yes?
Well, there isn't a time frame established. However, I believe the way the legislation is written, you know, when the board is satisfied that things are back on track and there's no need for even limited oversight, they then can make a recommendation to the governor to phase out the board and return complete control to the elected body. So that's one aspect of it. If, for example, the transition advisory board find that the progress really is not there and there are still issues related to the oversight by the elected body or the city administrator with the city, they can then make a recommendation to the governor that perhaps some other option might be better.
Which might even be going back under an emergency manager if that's what they feel it would take.
That's correct.
Now, I wanted to call your attention. I'm sure you saw a quote in this morning's Free Press with from ECOR City Councilman Gary Sammons, and he says, and here's his quote, "She wants to leave looking like a savior, but we're still in financial straits with costs that are going to increase and revenues that will keep going down as our housing values go down." What is your response, Joyce Parker, to that critic?
I haven't seen the newspaper, so it's really difficult for me to respond. But I guess my one recommendation and suggestion is that, you know, the mayor and the council there now have almost full control over operating the city, and we certainly cannot predict what's going to happen with the housing market, but I've noticed that it is stabilizing, and I suspect that it will stabilize in ECOURSE as well over time. So, you know, to a great extent, I think that's going to be the challenge in moving forward. We can anticipate what the future will hold, but I think a big part of it is basically having a plan in place and being conservative and anticipating what steps the city might take. And I think that's going to be the challenge.
There are, I don't need to tell you, there are many critics of the whole concept of an emergency manager, and they will point to cities in Michigan that had emergency managers. The EMs then left and the cities toppled back into financial trouble. And critics will say, see, it proves that the EM system is really not the answer. What do you say to that, and how do you know this won't happen in ECOURSE?
Well, you know, we don't know, but I think part of the reason why there's a provision within the legislation to have a transition advisory board is to give the cities the support necessary in order to sustain the changes that have taken place. You know, I think in the past, perhaps some cities did not stay the course, did not continue to manage the budget, was not able to project any issues that might be occurring into the future. And so as a result, you know, they reverted back to the way they used to operate based on the culture of that community. I think the transition advisory board certainly will be an asset to support communities, to give them a better chance of success.
And based on your association and work with the elected body, do you feel pretty confident that the people in place will be able to keep the course, stay the course?
Well, I think they understand the challenges the city has been faced with over the last 3.5 years. As you talk about pain, making those adjustments and changes, I think, was painful to the community, to the staff, to the bargaining unit. So I think there's a clear understanding of what has taken place. And in addition to that, the city of ECOURSE has been in receivership in the past. So given what they know, you know, I believe that there will be an effort to continue to move the city forward. And again, I think the city has an opportunity with having the advisory board there to assist if there's a need to do so.
And finally, Joyce Parker, what do you think other emergency managers and other cities in Michigan struggling with financial pressures, what could be learned from eCourse?
Well, you know, I think with the communities that are struggling, and certainly cities have a major challenge right now when you think about the fact that, you know, taxable values have gone down in some areas of the state. You know, they started increasing in other areas. They have not increased enough. But when you think about the challenges that cities are faced with, I think you have to kind of rethink how you operate. You have to put together a realistic plan. You have to really get more involved with building consensus and engaging the community in order to address some of those concerns. And so I would ask and think that cities across Michigan will be able to do their own self-assessment, get their residents involved, and you know, identify how they would like to move forward in terms of a strategy and a vision for their community.
Joyce Parker is the former emergency manager for the city of eCourse. She is also the current emergency manager of the city of Allen Park. Joyce, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we have finally entered the month of May, and it appears summer is right around the corner. May also brings a new sailing season for the last coal-fired ferry in the United States, the SS Badger. She's been making the 4-hour run from Ludington to Manitowoc, Wisconsin since 1953. At summer's peak, she makes that trip twice a day. The Badger is a key part of life in Ludington, bringing tourists, bringing their cash, and all of that means jobs and income in the small town. But there are growing environmental concerns. The Badger can dump up to 4 tons of coal ash slurry directly into Lake Michigan. But the EPA permit that allows that to happen is now under review, which could mean the Badger's days are numbered. Joining me now is Brandy Henderson. She's with Ludington's Visitors and Convention Bureau. Brandy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So talk to us first about just what the Badger means to Ludington in terms of the economy and jobs.
The car ferry has been for, you know, 60-plus years, been an icon for our community. So it's always had this very sentimental and nostalgic feeling for anyone who lives here or has visited here. But certainly beyond that, it means so much more. It's one of the top economic drivers in our community. A study way back in the 90s had proved that the car ferry, you know, brings about $21 million just to Ludington, and our sister port city of Manitowoc about $15 million. So it really is strength in our economy, and in this time we really need those jobs and that money and all the visitors that it brings here.
And I saw one figure that said something like 200 direct jobs because of the Badger. Does that ring true?
Absolutely, yeah. That's on both sides of the lake, but certainly a job is a job. And as we're on the uptick from 2009, we certainly need every job we can restore. So,
Brandy, I saw one quote in a news story from a Ludington resident who said, "We've got one little boat dumping a little bit of ash, but there are many who believe it is unacceptable in any way, shape, or form to be dumping coal ash into Lake Michigan." In fact, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin called Badger the filthiest ship on the Great Lakes. Your answer to them is what?
It is the last. It is the last coal steam-powered ship in the United States. And back when the SS Badger set sail on Lake Michigan, it was one of many. And the historical significance, I think, is where our community really feels like it's important that it sticks around. I think some of the facts have been a little exaggerated. They certainly have been operating within the EPA standards ever since and have taken steps in the last, I would say, 10 years to eliminate and use a cleaner burning coal and do whatever they can to be more environmentally friendly. And I think where they're at today, I think they're trying to be a good partner to the environment, but, you know, its historical significance is relevant, and that's why they continue to operate the way they do.
Well, last month brought a consent decree between the EPA and the company that owns the Badger, which is Lake Michigan Trans Lake Shortcut, Inc. And that agreement is the company will end coal ash discharge from Badger before 2015. In the meantime, it's supposed to reduce the coal it burns and the ash it discharges. So what would it take to accomplish that goal? Is that something that is doable?
I certainly think so. I know that they have been working very hard over the last few years to come up with some type of technology where they're able to keep their current boiler system, but find a way to be more environmentally friendly and meet these criteria. So I think it's definitely doable. I'm glad that they're hopefully going to get the time to be able to explore other options and make sure that they're doing the best option for themselves and for the ship. So
I know the 30-day public comment period on this proposed consent decree is up, and then it's on to whether or not this will be adopted. Obviously, Senator Durbin, he's saying he thinks this consent agreement is too weak. The question is, the technology does exist. Would they be able to switch the Badger over to diesel or natural gas?
As my knowledge is, yes. That was part of how they've come to this agreement, was to be able to show the steps that they're going to take to make sure that they can meet that deadline and meet all the requirements that the EPA is looking for. So we're really positive and looking forward to hearing the results of everything. We're all feeling really good and happy that they've been able to have the conversations that they have with the EPA. And I think with the support with our community and with the support on the other side of the lake and Badger lovers all across the country, I think we'll be able to show that this boat means something and it can continue to run.
You have your fingers crossed on the outcome after this public comment period, that this all comes together. But there are those who say 2 years is too long to wait. And to them, you say what?
I say, you know, we've operated this way for 60 years. And as I've said, I think the last 10 years they've taken many measures to burn the cleanest coal and to do whatever they can to be environmentally friendly. And they have been, you know, actively researching ways to make sure that they're doing what they can. So I think that 2 more years to give them the time to get to that point and to find whatever technology they need to use is a small step in blip in the timeline of the Badger.
I've been speaking with Brandi Henderson with Ludington's Visitors and Convention Bureau, and a special thanks to Stateside listener Bette Weston, who asked us to take a look and see what is going on with the Badger and with Ludington. And Brandi, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
When it comes to building bonds between people of different nations, different backgrounds, different ages, you just can't beat music. That's the lesson being learned by a group of students who came from the University of Michigan and a group of boys who live in an orphanage in Brazil. The story of how these young people from America are changing the lives of Brazilian orphans through violins, violas, and cellos is one that we really wanted to share with all of you. Joining me here in the studio is Ethan Shirley. He graduated from U of M and is the founder of the Pantanal Center for Education and Research. It's a nonprofit that works to integrate science, technology, and sustainable community development in third world countries. And joining us from England is University of Michigan graduate Alex Carney. Alex was the director and violin concertmaster for the Michigan Pops String Orchestra. These days, Alex is studying math at the University of Cambridge, where he is also the concertmaster of the Cambridge University Concert Orchestra. Thanks to both of you for joining us. I want to start with you, Ethan. From founding Pantanal, you've been going to Brazil, mostly science and technology projects, right?
Well, it kind of started off as science and technology projects that we're trying to direct to rural communities in order to help them get developed, but also in a way that was really in concert with nature and preserving the natural surroundings. And then from that, we kind of grew these educational programs with the science and technology into a local orphanage, and that's how we kind of set up this music project.
So you were at the Nazaré Orphanage, a boys' orphanage?
It's actually it's kind of a shelter for troubled youth or youth that have bad histories, victims of abuse, neglect of a lot of different kinds. Kids who are sent to this orphanage usually end up there by judicial mandate. because their families are in bad situations, they either can't provide for their kids or there are drugs and alcohol involved. Some of these kids come from the streets and are basically rescued by this orphanage. So it's kids that have these really, really difficult backgrounds. Yeah.
So they're there as a refuge, and there you were. And somehow I hear that you discovered a room full of stringed instruments?
Yeah, it turns out we were setting up some science and technology workshops, and the director told us of a bunch of instruments that were collecting dust in a room and just kind of said it in passing as if it was nothing. And I said, wait a second. I have a lot of people that like music, and I'm a musician myself, so I think we should do something with these instruments. And so it was kind of like we went to do something, but this other idea just popped out of nowhere, and I think it's a really great thing. And then we had kids coming up to us and being like, well, when are we going to learn music? When are we going to learn music? So,
now, what are the odds that you had folks that knew what to do with those stringed instruments? I guess we can cue Alex Carney for that. If you were the concertmaster for the Michigan Pop String Orchestra, I dare say you knew what to do when you saw that. What, Alex Carney, what possibilities did you see when you saw that room full of instruments?
Well, I'll definitely say I didn't see it going where it has. I was just thinking, well, I play violin, didn't have a violin with me in Brazil, so I thought I'd at least have some fun with it. If nothing else, just try and make sure the violins and violas and cellos are in all right shape. And so that was really all we were going for at first, and then the kids just really seemed to take well to it and have a great time with it, and I was having a blast. Everyone else was, I think. So it seemed really positive, and we just wanted to keep that going, and kind of that's how we've ended up here.
So where did it go? So you said you started with, well, we thought we'd have some fun for a couple of days, but where has this developed? What has it grown up into?
Since being in Brazil last summer, we've been recruiting some other musicians at University of Michigan and in the Michigan area to travel with us this summer to teach. And then also making connections down in Brazil, trying to partner with some other organizations there to try and make this not just something between a handful of Americans and the orphanage at Nazaré, but try and build this into something the community will embrace and support with us.
So it has truly become a music exchange project. And I'm going to let those of you who are listening know that we will be putting a link to their website up at michiganradio.org. And you have got to check out the wonderful, wonderful video of the kids in Brazil playing Hail to the Victors with Alex there at the helm. And I wondered, for both of you, give me your thoughts on what it was like watching this idea take hold with the kids and seeing them go, wait a minute, and what kind of possibilities, Ethan, do you think that the kids were beginning to realize by being able to pick up a violin and begin to make something of it?
Well, I think we take for granted here, especially in Ann Arbor, but in the United States in general, there are a lot of music programs involved in school. And in Brazil, in public schools in Brazil, there is no music. So this has really opened up a whole new world to a lot of these kids. So they were really excited because these instruments are very new. They're kind of mythical, mysterious instruments that nobody really knows how to play. And so it's adding a lot to their education, but also allowing them to just embrace this whole new world. And I guess the other thing is that we had the most luck actually teaching them or playing for them and helping them learn not only Hail to the Victors, but a lot of pop songs that they had heard, American pop songs on the radio. And that's kind of a way to connect us culturally, our pop music culture.
Sure.
Here and them through playing these instruments that are not typically pop or Brazilian music instruments.
You know, you're both busy people. I mean, Alex, you're over there in Cambridge, England, and Ethan, you've got things going on with the center, your Pantanal Center. What is it about what you've done there that is pulling you back?
Really just, I think, the excitement in the kids. And I will say, certainly, Brazil is not a bad place to be in the summer.
Sure, that's true.
Never object to a tropical place like that. But that excitement, this whole seeing some new ideas, some new creation that they didn't even know existed, that's what makes it seem worth it to me.
Certainly a testimonial to the power of music. And Ethan, for you, what are you personally getting from this?
Well, I actually have a pretty long history in the area of doing a lot of volunteer work, from teaching English to helping out develop these technology and science projects and stuff down there. So, you know, for me, it's more like it's great to see music getting involved because I have I'm passionate about music. But also, it's more like, you know, this is my second home. This is a community that I feel like I have some really strong bonds. It's really great to see music coming into this community and affecting those people in a positive way, in any positive way.
Got a total left brain, right brain thing going here. Alex Carney, who joined us from Cambridge, England, and Ethan Shirley here in the studio, both of them getting ready to head back to the Nazaré Orphanage in Brazil as part of this big music exchange program. And thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
The Pantanal Music Exchange is currently taking donations of used instruments, strings, music books, anything that could help the project this summer. For links to the Music Exchange, just go to the stateside link on our website at michiganradio.org. When you hear the word Wolverine, likely you think of Michigan. We've got the nickname the Wolverine State, and of course the University of Michigan and Wolverines are forever linked. So it's surprising when you sit back and realize the Wolverine never called Michigan home. The Wolverine population in the United States is anything but big. An estimated 250 to 300 Wolverines live in the lower 48. One of the experts devoting herself to protecting the Wolverine is, in fact, a Wolverine. She's a 1997 graduate of U of M's School of Natural Resources and Environment. These days, Bridget Fahey is the endangered species chief with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for the Mountain Prairie region. And Bridget is kind enough to join us now from Lakewood, Colorado. Hi, Bridget.
Hey, Cindy. How are you?
I am great. So this is funny when you stop and think about the fact, what, the Wolverine never actually lived in Michigan?
It probably never lived there enough to reproduce and have a population. But likely, the Wolverine wandered through Michigan on its travels because they will wander out far and wide from the areas that they do reproduce.
And this would have been a long, long time ago, right?
Yeah, probably before the 1850s.
I actually found something that indicated that it was Ohioans who gave Michigan the nickname Wolverine State when they were having that fight over Toledo, because it described Michiganians as being as vicious and bloodthirsty as Wolverine. So it was probably not the most complimentary nickname, was it?
Well, I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. I actually think that the Wolverine makes a great mascot for those very reasons. It's very tough and tenacious.
I was wondering, because you work with them, and I wondered what adjectives you would use to describe the Wolverine. So tough.
They are pretty, I would say they're pretty tough. They have a fierce reputation that is, I think, larger than their body size. They're in the weasel family, and weasels are known for being pretty spunky and pretty aggressive.
Now, am I right that by the early 1900s, the Wolverine nearly became extinct?
Yes, they did almost become extinct here in the lower 48. We still maintain healthy populations in northern Canada and Alaska.
But for the lower 48, things weren't faring too well. How are things today, though, in 2013?
Well, today, we actually think they've had a great recovery since the early 1900s. When they were almost lost, they were lost due to large-scale predator removal campaigns when we were first kind of colonizing the American West. And since that time, the states have protected them from being hunted and trapped, and they've slowly but steadily climbed up in population numbers. So that estimate of 250 to 300 is probably the highest numbers we've had in over a century.
So they're not on the endangered species list, but are they threatened? Are they considered a threatened species?
Not yet. We are in the process of evaluating that. So we have proposed to list them as threatened, and that process takes about a year while we seek public input. And we'll make our final decision in February of 2014.
And I guess it's just poetic justice that a Wolverine grad is helping to protect Wolverines. Do you think about that often?
I do. I was concerned that I might be biased in my role in this decision because of the background, but I think I was able to put that history aside and do a fair review.
Bridget Fahey is the endangered species chief with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for the Mountain Prairie region. And as we pointed out, just rather poetically, she's a 1997 grad of U of M School of Natural Resources and Environment. Bridget, good to talk with you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a special screening tonight at the AMC Livonia 20 of the documentary Stuck, an audience choice winner at the Heartland Film Festival. The film focuses on the process of international adoption and the children and prospective parents who get stuck in that process. The film tells the story of four children and the families who want to adopt them, following the children and families as they try to negotiate the bureaucratic ins and outs of the international adoption system. We're joined now by film producer Craig Juntinen, who joins us from his home in Scottsdale, Arizona. Welcome to Stateside, Craig.
Thank you, Cynthia. Thanks for having me.
And joining me in the studio, I welcome Kendra Pinkelman. She and her husband are trying to adopt a boy from Russia, which that process came to a grinding halt when Russia banned U.S. adoptions last December. Kendra, you drove up from Toledo. Thank you so much for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And from the Eastern Michigan Office of Adoption Associates in Farmington Hills, we have one of Michigan's leading agencies for international and domestic adoptions, represented by Paula Springer. Paula has worked in the adoption field for some 30 years. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you very much for including me too, Cynthia.
So, Craig, I'll start with you as the executive producer of Stuck. Also, you and your wife have adopted three children from Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
How did your own family's experience inform your film?
Well, it was a launching pad for the first of many red flags that I came upon. You know, when we went through our process, I realized there were some real glaring inefficiencies. I'm an entrepreneurial businessman. We'd retired. We decided to adopt these three magical children from Haiti. The key learning for me was twofold. One, kids are kids, whether they're born in Houston or Haiti. And two, the system of international adoption is inefficient and in some cases dysfunctional. And that dysfunctionality is at times damaging and or even destroying children. And so, and it's a silent, social tragedy. I mean, 8 out of 10 Americans believe international adoption is on the rise, when in fact, international adoption into the U.S. has fallen every year for 8 straight years. So we decided the time had come to create a national discussion about how to change this unnecessary situation. And the Stuck film and our nationwide tour is intended to share information and hopefully create a conversation about the importance of a family to every child. We're hoping that down the road, when common sense collides with this new information, change will occur.
And Kendra, you met a young Russian boy, mm-hmm. and your heart was clearly moved by him. And you met him last summer. Tell me the story.
Well, we live in Toledo, Ohio, and there's a lovely organization called Friends of Russian Orphans that has for the last 5 summers brought children from Russia from different orphanages to host families to get a family experience, which many of them either have never had or may never have again. We decided, well, sure, this would be great for our kids. What a neat experience for us to give a child something. And we were blown away because we were the ones that got the most out of it, I think, of this deal, because we met this little boy, age 7, big brown eyes, just lovely, full of life, and fell in love with him. And the day he left to go back to Russia, they were here for 2.5 weeks. The day he left, we started the process because we knew we didn't want him to sit there any longer than he needed to. Mm. So we started, moved fast. Our agency, which happens to be Adoption Associates as well, moved quickly with us, and we made our first trip in November to tell him face-to-face, we want you. We want you in our family. We love you. And, of course, as you know the rest of the story, the ban came down about 3 weeks after we returned from our trip, and now we've been in this holding pattern. And, unfortunately, we're not the only ones in this. There's 230 to 250 other families. And that includes 300 children, because some of these families are adopting sibling groups or more than one child. And these children are stranded. They're stuck. And these are all children that met their parents. These are parents that were able to make the trip, mm-hmm. say, we want you.
Paula Springer, what in your experience, how typical is what's happened with Kendra? And I'm really interested in your experience, what the average time of an international adoption is from start to finish.
I'll address both those questions. The situation that Kendra's family is dealing with is different because of this Russian ban on adoptions. And so now we're dealing with the fact that they were in process, met this child, were completely committed to him and wanting to bring him home. And now there's this, you know, international law that we struggle with. And part of what happens is that an international adoption has to complete and follow procedures in both the source country, the country like Russia or Ethiopia or Haiti. Each country would have its own established procedure for adoption in that country, and they vary by country. They're completely different in every country. The time frames, the requirements, what needs to go to the country, the number of trips people have to make, and so those things vary by country, and we must follow those rules and regulations, and then also follow the U.S. laws regarding adoption, bringing a child of foreign birth into this country. And so it gets very complicated, and especially when we have political things happening, political leadership changes, politics can influence change and policy in country. And so we have these high-level things happening that affect the children. And I'm so glad to see this movie Stuck bring this to people's attention. People need to know and understand what's happening on a personal level instead of this large, you know, vision of political changes. We need to take children's best interest into heart. And we completely support groups being a catalyst for change in international adoption, trying to be a part of bringing more children to their forever families. The time frames vary differently. Again, like I said, per country, every country is different. It also depends on the age of the child you're bringing home, the availability of children in that country. And so it varies quite a bit. But there is a time process. Family has to complete their home study, complete a series, a lot of documentation. It's paperwork intensive to be presented to that country, then go through the legal process there, usually visit, bring the child home. So there's many, many steps which take it a long time, and that does become quite cumbersome.
And it costs money.
It does.
That was Paula Springer, who's with Adoption Associates here in the Eastern Michigan area, and she's been in the adoption field for some 30 years. Also talking with Kendra Pinkelman, who was in the process of adopting a 7-year-old boy from Russia, and then Russia slammed the door last December. So they indeed, and the boy they want to bring home and to become his forever family, they're stuck. And Craig Juntinen joining us from Scottsdale, who's the producer of the documentary Stuck, looking at this problem. And Craig, you say that there are glaring inefficiencies and the system is dysfunctional. What do you see in your experience and through the film? Where are these inefficiencies? Where is it so dysfunctional?
Well, most of the process is done manually. And so at the heart of the issue is determining eligibility. Does this family represent a suitable, sane, healthy, safe environment for the child? And then on the child's side, does the child have a legitimate need as somebody who's living outside of parental care? And in many cases, this determination of eligibility is done on a fairly lackluster basis, all done manually, despite the fact that we have not only common sense, but plenty of scientific evidence that tells us that every day matters in the life cycle of a child. So what's happened is that as people start to hear about the international adoption process, and then they hear about these bureaucratic obstacle courses, and they hear about these stories like Russia that shut down in mid-process, they get discouraged, and they walk away from the process. And we've done a couple of studies, and one of the key studies we did early on in 2009 told us that the perception of adoption in our country has grown from 1997 to 2009. There was, in fact, a significant spike of about 13 percent points in terms of the overall favorable impression about international adoption.
All right.
But you're seeing this precipitous decline in real activity. So you have to ask, well, why are we having this precipitous decline when the perception of the activity is well received? And simply, all of our eyes have pointed to it's not because families don't want to adopt or like the idea of adopting, and it's not that there certainly isn't a plentiful supply of children who really need and deserve a family. It's because the process is actually discouraging the activity. And we need to really recognize what's in the best interest of the child. And in a process, there has to be safety, transparency, first and foremost. But then there also has to be some sort of efficiency to determine eligibility so that child has a pathway to a family, both relative to in an efficient manner, and so that more families can participate.
Paula, as you've worked in this field for so many decades, what do you advise people when they come to you and they're saying, well, we're considering international adoption? What kind of expectations are set right at the outset?
We want them to begin to educate themselves about adoption. What is the process they'll go through? What are the type of children who are eligible? What does it mean bringing a child into your home who may have lived in an orphanage or, you know, in some level of lack? And help them understand what do they need to do to be prepared to bring this child home in a successful way. We can't change the process. The process that I think Craig is talking about is more in country in terms of speeding up that appropriate, you know, referral process, determining eligibility, and I certainly wish we could do more to help that. One of the things that you did mention also was sometimes a factor in discouraging people might be the cost. And in international adoption, you know, clearly there is cost because there are agency fees and country fees, travel fees, and we do educate people to try to look at what are their resources to help them in that so the cost does not become a discouraging factor. And thankfully, our federal government did pass legislation that allowed the adoption tax reimbursement to happen. So there's an adoption tax credit available, and there's a lot of information about that to determine eligibility that helps with a significant part of the cost. There are some businesses and organizations that do employee adoption reimbursement. So again, looking to see maybe there are some ways to ease the burden of that part of the adoption process, and we provide families with a lot of information to help them with that part too.
I'd like the thoughts of any of you who want to answer this, and maybe just, I wonder how much of this being stuck in the inefficiencies and the dysfunctionalities how much is because of policies here in the U.S. and how much is because of policies of another country? Oh boy, yeah, Kendra, you just went. Oh. But of course, with your situation, was there any way of knowing that Russia was going to slam the door shut on adopting to the U.S.?
We didn't see that personally coming. We were encouraged when we were in country because we had to sign an intent to adopt this child. Mm-hmm. So we signed a contract, a legally binding contract, saying we are adopting him. And when we were there, our representative from the Ministry of Education was very encouraging and just, he sort of, looking back now, I can see he was maybe hurrying us along for a purpose, knowing this was on the horizon. But he was very, you know, please, please hurry, get your paperwork in and you can get this child home quicker. And now looking back again, 2 weeks later, Obama signed the Magnitsky Act and everything that followed sort of dominoed. And, you know, we moved pretty fast, so I don't think we could have done it any better on our end. Unfortunately, I think politics plays a huge part in this.
What I would say relative to this is that I think first and foremost, we have to convince the world that these kids' lives matter.
Right.
And that we need a more proactive stance on recognizing that it's in their best interest to get them into a family. And I do believe that globally we can begin to look at facilitating process reform. What hasn't happened so far is there hasn't been any cross-border knowledge sharing. There hasn't been any real communication. One of the things our foundation, the Both Ends Burning Campaign Foundation, wants to do is have a Summit of Nations meeting where we bring 25 countries together for 3 or 4 days and do nothing but talk about the current best practices of the process, the current best opportunities for improvement, and start to share some information. I think over the next 2 or 3 years, we actually engaged in some global information exchange. And we were basically aggregators and purveyors of information about this process. We could begin to make change. I think it's not in the best interest of the global children population to say, well, it is what it is and we can't deal with it. I think we need to start reaching out, challenge the current expectation globally, and encourage people to start looking for better ways. Change happens all the time. And I think if we come together as a society and say, what is in the best interest of all of these children, and we recognize the science that says a permanent, safe, loving family is in their best interest, well, good. Then let's get to work and figure out new ways to begin to facilitate at-risk children to join a family.
It makes me, yeah, because it does make me wonder as I think of this message of stuck, what can families like Kendra's and all the other families who are stuck, how do you influence that foreign nation?
Well, I think, this is Craig again, mm-hmm. I think the first thing we can do is we can begin to form the political will and the social will in our country to become a leader. And in fact, there's a new piece of legislation that's going to be announced tomorrow that really will be, I think, a key first step for the U.S. to take a leadership position in the process of reforming the international adoption system.
Kendra, I'd like to get your thoughts and kind of end with your hopes, what recourse you have, where things stand for you, and really what your heart hopes for this little boy that captured it last summer.
Well, first and foremost, I certainly hope at some point this little guy comes to live with us. We have two children of our own, and they're expecting a brother. Our families met this child this summer. He's part of our family. Our situation is unique, but there's all these other families that are in the same boat. I personally hope, as Craig said, you know, our government can step up and be leaders, and I do hope that President Obama, Secretary of State Kerry, I hope that they take the initiative to meet with President Putin, because I think there is the possibility that we can be examples to turn the tide. So that's my hope and prayer for our families, the Russian families that are stuck and waiting. There's so many children that need homes.
Stuck will be screened as part of the national tour tonight at the AMC Livonia 20, and there'll be a question and answer session afterward with one of the attorneys who is featured in the film, so that's a real worthwhile resource. And then if you can't make the screening, you can get a lot more information about the film, and the website is stuckdocumentary.com. And we've been speaking with one of the very, very wonderful families that wants to be a forever family for a child from Russia, Kendrick Pinkelman, who joined us. Paula Springer of Adoption Associates, thank you so much. And executive producer of Stuck, Craig Juntinen, thanks for joining us from Scottsdale.
Thank you for having me, yes.
It was a good dialogue. I'm sure we'll be continuing it. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
And we want to remind you, be sure to tune in for a special one-hour State of Opportunity documentary on race and how it affects the success of children in our state. That'll be tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Michigan Radio. Stateside was produced and directed today by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.